Well, welcome everyone. I'm Dr. Amanda Ryman, and I am the Chief Knowledge Officer for New Frontier Data. We also run the CMED clinics where you can get your medical cannabis recommendation in several different states. And I'm very excited to welcome our guest today, Dr. Thomas Gerhart. He is a physician, and we're going to be chatting a bit about the process of becoming a medical cannabis patient, what you need to know to determine whether cannabis may be right for you, and what happens once you become a patient. A lot of folks out there go through the process of becoming a patient, and then they're left with the question of how do I find the right products for me, and how do I determine what products work best? So we're going to get into all of that today, and we're so excited for you to join us. Dr. Gerhart, thank you so much for being on the podcast today, and do you want to take a minute to introduce yourself?
Yeah, of course. Thank you so much for having me. This is kind of a newer experience for me, so I'm looking forward to this. So as said, my name is Dr. Thomas Gerhart. I am a physician who attended family medicine residency. Currently I do medical cannabis recommendations with, CMED. And, you know, a little bit about me and how I kind of got involved in this. To be honest, when I was in residency, I got extremely burned out on the way the current medical system was. I didn't feel like anything I was doing was making patients better. I felt like I didn't have time to address anything with patients, and all medications that I was giving were either prolonging a problem or causing new problems. And I almost left medicine entirely, frankly. But then I kind of decided, well, you know, maybe let's approach this from a different way. I'm going to kind of, you know, do things my way, but in a more holistic manner. And that kind of led me into this field, and I've been doing this now for a couple of years, and I absolutely love what I do.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad that we didn't lose you completely from the world of medicine, because we need more people like you. We need more physicians that are willing to take a more holistic view of health, that aren't just, you know, following a very narrow track about what it means to provide healthcare, and really focusing on a more patient-centered approach. And I think that medical cannabis care is very patient-centered, because it's really starting with the needs of the patient and how can we support them and think outside the box and think about different ways that we might reduce the potential harms of current medications and help support them in their journey towards finding something that's going to work best for them. So really appreciate you being with us today. And, you know, we're going to start with a pretty pragmatic discussion about becoming a medical cannabis patient. Most every state now has some kind of law supporting access to the medicinal use of cannabis. And even if that's a CBD only law, or only allowing certain types of products, all the way up to your very comprehensive laws that allow access to all kinds of products for an unlisted number of conditions, there are people in every state who may be interested in becoming a medical cannabis patient. So as I mentioned, one of the things that differs from state to state is the list of qualifying conditions. Some states like California have a completely open-ended list of conditions. It's whatever your doctor feels may be right for you. Other states, such as the state of Oregon or Washington, where I live, have a finite list of conditions, and you have to have a specific type of diagnosis in order to qualify for medical cannabis. So how do people know what's legal in their state? How do they better understand if the condition they're experiencing is something that qualifies them?
Yeah, so it is definitely a complicated issue when you are trying to compare state to state to state, because as you said, every state has their own set of qualifying conditions. And, you know, their own criteria as to what it takes to actually get a certification to have medical cannabis. Honestly, one of the best ways you can figure this out is to simply do some internet searches. You might have to look for your state's specific cannabis registry. Usually they'll have some sort of web page regarding the registry specifically that you can then look at, and usually they will list the qualifying conditions, or at the very least, you'd have some contact info and you could contact them saying, "Hey, I'm curious about getting this. What are the lists of qualifying conditions, or what do I need to do?" But generally, the information is going to be online on different state websites. But also, don't be afraid to call any sort of office that does these cannabis recommendations, because they usually, if they operate within your state, will know what is allowed in each state. And so those are a good resource as well to, reach out to.
Yeah, and that's great advice. I mean, every state that has a medical cannabis program is likely going to have a website that's going to give information for potential patients. And something that I want to point out is what you said about not being afraid to call. You know, cannabis has been so stigmatized, it has been illegal. There have been great punishments doled out for even admitting that you're a cannabis consumer. And that can make some people shy or scared about calling and asking a state agency, how do I qualify to use this substance that until very recently was criminalized? So, for those folks that are listening, I want to assure you that one, nobody can do anything to you for calling and asking this question. And two, if you live in a state that has medical cannabis, this is why that agency exists. It exists to help people just like you who have these questions. So even though I understand it can be a little bit anxiety provoking to think I'm calling someone in charge in government and asking how I can access cannabis, that is what these offices are here for. And like Dr. Gerhardt said, most of these agencies will have a list, they'll have a guide on their website to how to become a medical cannabis patient, and that will include the list of qualifying conditions. And states are adding conditions all the time. I just read this morning that Oregon is considering adding female orgasmic disorder. Yay, Oregon. I remember going to Oregon a decade ago and fighting with them to add PTSD to their list of conditions. So, as we see medical cannabis evolve, both in practice and in research, we are seeing states adding conditions, being a little bit more lenient about who can obtain medical cannabis, which is a really great thing to see. So, maybe you're in a state and your condition did not qualify a couple years ago. Check back, you know, keep checking because some states just eliminate the finite list of conditions altogether and say that it is now the decision between you and your doctor. So keep your eye on those conditions because they do change. Okay, so you are a doctor who works in medical cannabis practice. A big reason why this specialty exists is because one, doctors are not taught about cannabis or the endocannabinoid system in med school. And two, as you mentioned, kind of more traditional medicine, you know, has a skeptical view of medical cannabis. And so people don't feel comfortable talking to their primary care provider about medical cannabis. And they want to seek out a physician that they know, one, has a little bit more information and background and knowledge about the use of cannabis as medicine, and two, isn't going to judge them, and isn't going to stigmatize them for asking the question. So my question to you is, you know, when should people think about talking to their general physician or a specialist that they're seeing about medical cannabis? And if that's not possible or not advisable, how do they find a medical cannabis specialist in their area?
Right. So yes, I definitely would like to, restate like what you said earlier, like we doctors in medical school are not taught anything about medical cannabis or the endocannabinoid system. Just we didn't even touch it. But getting into this, it really is involved in a lot of different systems. For example, even like what we refer to as the runner's high. So if you're exercising and you've been running for a while and you get those good endorphins, those are largely endocannabinoids that your body is producing and using. And there's even been research that's shown that using just a little bit of THC, CBD before an exercise like that promotes that runner's high and generally makes the experience better. But that's a system that we just are never taught. We have no idea. And so that's the thing with a lot of doctors is they just have no idea how it works. They just weren't taught. And then, and to give, doctors the benefit here, they're busy trying to keep up on other things, depending on their specialty. Medicine's changing all the time. And so, they're spending all of their free time learning about their specialty and changes in that. They don't really have time to keep up with something that's really outside of their field. So, usually where people first mention this to their doctor is going to be to their primary care physician. Oftentimes they'll ask questions like, do you use alcohol? Do you smoke? And then there's usually the question of, do you use cannabis? And usually at that point is when it comes up, you say, yes, I use cannabis, but I have a medical card. And then you kind of have one of three things that might happen with different doctors. You might have a doctor that says, oh, okay, that's great. Tell me about it. What are you using it for? How's it helping you? You might have some doctors that approach it with a little bit of skepticism, that don't say anything one way or the other, but in the end support you as a patient and want to work with you. And then you'll have the doctor who has, heard of all the stigma and is said like, oh, nope, we need to stop that. That's probably causing a lot of your medical issues, yada yada. There is not a shortage of doctors that I've talked to that have blamed various health problems on cannabis use, which frankly is absurd in a lot of cases. But that's just kind of the state that this is all in right now. So, when you bring this to your doctor's attention, I think the biggest thing is just to be honest and open. Tell them about why you're using it. And especially if it's for something that you've been treated for in the past, what has your treatment plan been up to this point? Like if you are a chronic pain patient, for example, basically, like what medications did you use in the past? Did you use opiates? Did you use gabapentin? Did you use NSAIDs? Did you have any surgeries? Did you have procedures? Like, what was the path leading up to you getting your medical card to help them understand that, why you've chosen this route? Because a lot of times it's, they take opiates and they're like, well, obviously that just made things worse. They did a surgery, didn't help. These previous things that were offered to them are no longer helping. And they're like, this is why I turned to this. And I think that's important to say because some doctors might assume that you're just using it to treat your condition and that you haven't actually gone through the medical treatment process. They say, oh, well, we've got better options than that. When really you're like, yeah, I've already done those and it didn't work. That's why I'm here. So, that's kind of a big thing. But then, depending on, if your doctor's at least, listening and is there for you, then it's important to at least consider their opinion on this. Especially when it comes to like very specialty care.
That's what I was going to ask. So, there's the primary care provider, and then there are people that are specialty doctors that are treating you for a specific condition or disease. And I think about oncologists. I think about chronic pain specialists. I think about doctors that treat disorders like ALS and other movement disorders. So is there a higher rate of acceptance or knowledge about medical cannabis among specialists who are treating conditions that are widely known to be impacted by cannabis, more so than like a primary care provider in your experience?
Yeah, definitely. Especially oncologists. I feel like oncologists, they probably get this question from almost every patient about could I use medical cannabis for my issues? Because a lot of times it revolves around side effects due to chemotherapy or pain or nausea related to the cancer itself. And so they get this question all the time. And so they are more than willing to address it and oftentimes have positive, opinions about it. That said, depending on what system that they work in, if they work in a large healthcare system that generally receives federal funding like Medicare, Medicaid, things like that, grants and whatnot. Because cannabis is still federally illegal, they can't really talk about it one way or the other. They can say, oh, that's a good option. But they're not going to say like, oh yeah, absolutely use this, because they're kind of legally tied in that respect.
Right.
Because if this organization started openly promoting cannabis, they could lose all their federal funding. So
Right.
sometimes they'll dance around it a little bit when they talk about it.
So let's say that you have talked to your primary care provider, you've talked to your specialty provider, and they're like, yeah, I think that could be useful or helpful, or people with your condition have found that helpful. I can't recommend it for the reasons that you just mentioned. So now you kind of have the half blessing of your medical provider, but you now need to go out and find a cannabis specialist, somebody that will write you a recommendation. What is that process like? Because there are so many out there, and through Relaxed Clarity and CannaCare Docs, we provide those services. What should people be looking for when they're going out to look for a medical cannabis recommendation? I mean, are they all the same? Is it just a matter of how much you want to pay? Or what are some of the things they should look for when making that decision?
Right. So getting that sort of half blessing, but not really being able to get a med card from there is pretty much where I step in. And for me, the biggest thing that I would say to look for, in an office, I mean, price is important, don't get me wrong, money's tight for everyone. But also, look for places that generally have a good reputation, especially if they have good reviews or stating about physicians who actually take their time and will talk to you, answer your questions. Because some places, it is a 5 minute in and out. Like, here, just what's your problem? Okay, cool, sounds good. Here's your cert. Go to the dispensary, and then you're kind of left there going like, whoa, wait, what am I supposed to do with this now? And so some places can be real minimal like that. I personally like to ask my patients questions like, what is this being used for? What have you done in the past? And trying to figure out like, is this going to be a good option for you? And if so, can I steer you towards, certain products that would be more beneficial in your case? And I think that's an important thing to look for. You can honestly get a good sense of that, not only just online from reviews, but even going to dispensaries and just asking like, hey, do you have any providers that you recommend around here that do these certifications? And usually they'll have a list of like, oh yeah, these doctors are great. We've heard good things about them. And and it's important to note that like, I personally, as a physician, I cannot receive any kickbacks from any dispensary. So it's not like I can pay a dispensary per patient they send me
Right.
as a physician. I can't do that. I am a neutral party. And so, if they're telling you to come to me, it's just likely because I have a good reputation. It's not because I paid them or anything.
Well, I've definitely experienced the wide variety of provider encounters. I was a medical cannabis patient for over 20 years, and every year I went to the same physician, Dr. Frank Lucido in Berkeley. It was an inpatient, in-office visit. There was an extensive intake form to fill out beforehand. It was a full exam, lots of questions. And then 1 year out of those 20, I was working for a dispensary. And back then in California, they recommended that everyone at the dispensary have a medical card so that you legally could be at the dispensary. They sent us all to the same doctor, and it was literally like 30 seconds. I mean, I took the opportunity, since I know a lot about cannabis, to challenge this doctor a bit with some questions that he did not know the answer to. It was strictly a rubber stamp. And I will say that for people that already know a lot about cannabis, people that have been using for a long time, that know the products they like, that know where to get it, maybe they've talked to their regular doctor extensively about this already. That may be an okay thing, right? Just to kind of go through and get the recommendation so that you can then access the dispensary. But I would say for most people, that isn't enough. And they do want to talk to the doctor. They do want some questions answered. They do want someone that understands cannabinoid medicine. Because in the next section, we're going to talk about some contraindications. And cannabis is a very safe medication, especially compared to some of the other options out there for treating things like pain and sleep. But it's not without risk. And when you have a doctor that doesn't understand the right questions to ask about other medications you may be taking or family or personal history of certain conditions, then you may have kind of a careless recommendation that doesn't come without the necessary information to make sure that it's safe. And so I think for most people seeking to use cannabis as medicine, it is important that they talk to a doctor. So before we move on to that section, I just also want to cover a little bit about some of the state law differences in how you get a recommendation. So can you talk a little bit about how that might differ from state to state about what the process of getting certified might be?
Yeah, so each state has its own particular laws about what you kind of have to do before you get a recommendation. So I'm pretty much based out of Colorado, and for our process, you have to make an appointment. It has to be in person. The state law says it has to be done in an office. I have to see you in person. And then from there, I submit my certification to the state, and then the patient, after that visit, we'll then go on to the state registry and apply to get the medical card. And then in that application, it links my certification with their application. And then the state kind of looks it over and then issues the medical card. Other states, telemedicine is allowed. And so, it doesn't have to be an in-person visit. You can just do a Zoom call, essentially, and get the recommendation over the phone. Then there's like I want to say it's Delaware did something interesting where if you're over 65, you can almost self-certify because it's kind of like, well, at this point, you know your body. And so they allow patients to self-certify. So it does totally differ by region, but and of course, trying to find the doctors that do these recommendations in your state and asking them, hey, what does the process look like? Do I need to come in? Could we do a telemed? They're going to be a great resource for that. To tell you, like, for example, you're in Colorado. Yep, we got to see you here in office. But once you get that done, the med card gets issued in just a couple of days.
Yeah, I know. And when I was living in California, for a while there, you had to get your med card from your local Department of Public Health after you got your recommendation. During COVID, a lot of the departments of public health either shut down or had very limited hours. So they went back to allowing you to use your doctor's recommendation as your entree into the dispensary. So going back to the same thing as qualifying conditions, go on the website of the Department of Medical Cannabis in your state. They should tell you exactly what the process is in order to get that medical card, what you need to have, whether it's an in-person visit or not. So some of the benefits of being a medical cannabis patient, because medical patients, the assumption is that they have some different needs than an adult use consumer. Maybe they need more cannabis more often. They may be on fixed income because they have a chronic illness that they're having to deal with. So what are some of the advantages of being a medical cannabis patient?
And first, I just want to take a step back to first thing I wanted to mention was just like again, kind of touching on the don't be afraid to ask kind of thing. Don't be afraid to ask the state, don't be afraid to call the offices, and don't be afraid to go see a medical cannabis doctor if you've never used cannabis in your life. I have patients all the time who are like, I've never done cannabis ever. But they're like, I'm at my wit's end here. I've tried all these other treatment options and they haven't worked. Don't be afraid to, come to us. Like that's what we're here for. So absolutely don't be afraid. The main benefits of having a medical card, it does depend on state by state. So some states you can't get cannabis without a medical card. There's no recreational side to it. And so that's your only option. Here in Colorado, we have both medical and recreational. So I get this question all the time of like, why should I get a medical card here when there's plenty of recreational dispensaries around? And it comes down to a few things. The biggest one, I feel like, for a lot of people is the taxes. Generally, medical cannabis is taxed at a much lower rate than recreational taxes. Here in Colorado, our recreational tax approaches 30 some percent by the time you add state, county, city taxes. If you're spending $100 on product, it's $30 to tax. The medical tax is about 3%. And so, if you can imagine that, for every $100 you spend, you saved $27 in taxes. And that adds up pretty quickly.
Oh, absolutely. Here in Washington, it's 37% tax on adult use, and they just passed a law eliminating that tax for medical patients. So that's a 37% reduction in savings. And again, if you're somebody that has a chronic illness, cannabis is something that you need to have with you. That can add up fast, especially because the products you might need may be on a little bit more of the expensive side, like tinctures or high THC oils. So I do think that those tax savings definitely come into play. In California, the savings is just the sales tax, which is like 8-something%, which isn't great, but it is something.
Yeah, and the other thing too is it's kind of both a cost effectiveness thing and a convenience thing is like ex again in Colorado, edibles can be a lot stronger on the medical side. The tinctures, edibles, things like that can be stronger. On the recreational side, you're limited to 10 milligrams of THC per edible, 100 milligrams per package on the recreational side. Some people need they need 50 milligrams per dose to have an effect. That means they're having to eat half of the package every time they want a dose. The cost of that adds up quickly. And if you're doing like gummies, eating five gummies at a time gets old pretty fast.
Yeah.
It becomes more of a hassle than it's worth. On the medical side in Colorado, you can get edibles that are 50 milligrams per gummy or 100 milligrams per edible, 1,000 milligrams per package, much stronger doses. And so people oftentimes can buy a set of edibles and even cut them up into smaller doses and take it that way. And that's going to be a lot more of a cost-effective solution than having to, go through half of a package every time you dose.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, here in Washington, products that are for medical patients also go through more rigorous testing protocols. So they have certain things they test for a medical product that they do not test for an adult use product, which, you could say, well, they should test everything, for everyone. But if you are immunocompromised or, have a medical condition, you may be more sensitive to certain things being in the product. Another difference here in Washington is that you can only grow your own if you're a medical patient. Now, I really hope they change that. I don't really think that makes much sense, but it's another reason to become a medical patient because, again, growing your own is the most cost-effective way to get your medicine because that's definitely less expensive than purchasing flower or edibles at the dispensary. And then in California, you can have higher purchase limits. So if you're an adult use consumer, you're limited to 1 ounce when you buy it at the dispensary of flower. I believe if you're a patient, it's 4 ounces of flower at the dispensary, and also possession limits, how much you can have on you at a time. So, if you're somebody that uses a lot of cannabis for medical reasons, like you said, you might think, well, I'm in an adult use state. I have access to it either way. But those things do add up, and they are things that are specifically focused on people who need cannabis regularly in certain amounts from certain products and may have certain health vulnerabilities because of their condition.
Yeah, absolutely. It's here in Colorado, it's the same kind of thing. Recreational adult use products, you can buy an ounce at a time, an ounce per day, where medicals is about 2 ounces. But then there is the option that we have here in the state called an extended plant count, which is essentially allows you to purchase even more than that. And that usually is going to be dependent upon A few things such as, you know, the severity of the disability, the location of the patient. So a lot of Colorado is quite rural, and there is no dispensaries within a 3-4 hour drive. And so, you know, an extended plant count makes sense for them because they can either grow a large amount at their home, or when they do make a trip to go to a dispensary, it can be worth their while. You know, to try and stock up for everything instead of, you know, needing to go to the drive 3 hours every couple of weeks, just to obtain what you need.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, most states like Colorado, California, Oregon, Washington that have urban areas and then a lot of rural areas and also allow local control. So allow communities to decide whether or not they're going to allow cannabis retail into that community, have, you know, what we refer to as cannabis deserts, where cannabis may be legal in that state. You may have a right to purchase it, but there is no retail opportunity within a very far way of where you live. So yes, being able to grow a large amount for yourself or being able to stock up when you make that trip, is really important for medical patients. All right, so I think we've covered how you become a patient, what to look for, where to find that information, how to talk to your doctor, how to find a medical cannabis specialist, what the benefits are of becoming a patient. Let's talk a little bit about the healthcare behind being a medical cannabis patient. So we've already mentioned some conditions, things like cancer, movement disorders, insomnia. Can you talk a little bit about some of the conditions that we have fairly strong evidence that where cannabis can be beneficial?
Yeah, so you know, like we talked about earlier, every state has their own, you know, list of recommendations, but they all generally tend to follow a similar pattern. They all generally tend to treat roughly similar things, and then there's like a couple of things that are unique to each state, possibly. But like for example, chronic pain is probably the number one. I would say that's just about everywhere. You know, conditions that results in severe chronic pain are going to be on that list. And conditions resulting in severe and chronic nausea can you know are oftentimes listed on there. So things like irritable or like inflammatory bowel disease or irritable bowel syndrome you know are options as well. Typically things like migraines or you know history of any traumatic injury where you've had to have like surgery and you have hardware in place and now it just hurts every time the weather changes. You know, those are good options. You know, any condition really where an opiate could be an option, cannabis is also an option. You know, and then you know, there's a few different things like here in Colorado where, you know, we have PTSD, that was a recent addition, as well as autism. Autism, there is a huge benefit to cannabis use in cases of autism, and you know that's one that our state here has. And then even interesting like glaucoma is one that's just on our list. People use it to help control their pressures, you know, in their eyes and any visual issues. That's something that's there. But certainly the chronic pain, chronic nausea, cancer patients, we have a lot of evidence showing how it's helpful. And there's even been FDA, essentially FDA kosher THC or CBD that's been developed. Oh, I forgot to mention seizures. That's another big one that shows up in most every state, epilepsy, things like that, or like childhood seizure disorders. And there's even approved, you know, FDA kosher THC or CBD. Like for example, Marinol is a synthetic THC that it can be used for cancer patients. Now, I will say it tends not to work very well. The experience I've had for most patients is it just doesn't really seem to help a whole lot, and that's due to likely what we think is something called an entourage effect, which we could probably do an entire podcast episode on that. But more or less, it's the idea that you need multiple different cannabinoids all working together to actually make it work. And so when you have
I describe the entourage effect like a symphony. So, like you can have a single instrument and it can be pretty, but when you add all the instruments, even in different levels of volume, it's a much more rich and holistic effect.
Yeah,
And
and it fits different places. Like it you know, it's you know, it's not all like in the symphony example, it's not all high pitched instruments. You've got your bass instruments, you've got your percussion, you know, they're all doing different things, but they work together to create this wonderful thing.
well, let me ask you about mental health, because that I know has been a bit of a controversial thing when it comes to cannabis. Talking about things like chronic pain, seizure disorders, those are people are like, okay, I get that, right? Like that makes sense to me. But I think partially because the old stigma around cannabis causing mental illness, it makes people a little bit hesitant to be as gung-ho when we're talking about using cannabis to treat anxiety or depression or some of these other mental, even PTSD, some of these other mental health related conditions. Can you talk a little bit about using cannabis for mental health conditions? And is that impacted by previous self or family history of having certain conditions? What is the relationship between cannabis and use for mental health? Because we know when we interview consumers, when we survey consumers, anxiety, insomnia, and relaxation are the top three reasons why people use cannabis. And you could argue that all three of those are more mental health conditions and physical health conditions. Those even beat out chronic pain. So can you talk a little bit about that, what you see in your practice, what we see in the research, and should anyone who wants to use cannabis for a mental health condition, kind of what precautions should they be taking?
Yeah, so with regards to, you know, mental health, like yes, I get that all the time. People use it for anxiety, insomnia, depression, things like that. But, you know, we've all probably heard that the expression of reefer madness. That was the
Right.
stigma that went around that, you know, you use cannabis and your brain turns into Swiss cheese and just total garbage.
Sure.
But that was kind of the thing for decades. And so, you know, we're slowly coming back to that. But generally the evidence with treating anxiety, depression, insomnia isn't super well understood. And while I see the benefit to a lot of patients, it's not typically a approved qualifying condition in several states. So Colorado, for example, the only condition that I would say is mental health that's approved is the PTSD. You know, everything else is some sort of physical or organic cause, you know, not necessarily a psychological one. And so, you know, that's something to keep in mind when you're looking up your qualifying conditions in your state, is that anxiety, depression are probably not going to be a qualifying condition. But that said, you shouldn't be afraid to try cannabis for your symptoms, especially things that with THC and CBD. The CBD really, really can help offset that anxiety. But CBD, again, with that entourage effect, CBD by itself tends not to really do anything. You need something else with it, some amount of THC, some other cannabinoids with it to really get the full anxiety relieving effect. And on the other end, you know, if you have anxiety and you use cannabis, you want to be careful about using too much THC,
Right.
because one of the kind of major side effects of using too much THC is it's going to provoke some anxiety. It might provoke a little bit of paranoia, kind of like a not so much like a paranoia of like CIA is stalking me, but more of a paranoia in that like it seems like the subjective experience I've heard from patients is like they just feel like everyone's mad at them. Then they kind of have this like, oh man, I'm just a horrible person. I feel like everything's going wrong. That can happen if you do too much THC, but the CBD will actually counteract that. So adding both of those things, the CBD and THC, really help to counteract that anxiety effect. And then the other thing to really be cautious of is things like schizophrenia. That's been kind of a big one where, you know, you'll hear people talk about like, oh, my son used cannabis and now he has schizophrenia. Well, okay, so there's a bit to unpack with that. There is some evidence that, you know, using a very large amount of cannabis for a very long period of time in adolescence could potentially lead to the development of a psychotic issue like schizophrenia. That said, it's we don't know the precise dose response relationship, but we know generally it has to do with high doses. Like kids that are 13, 14 that are using way too much cannabis, can cause these issues. But also, if they used way too much alcohol or way too much of another substance, they'd probably be messing themselves up even more, to be frank. And but if that's something you're concerned about, one thing that you might want to pay attention to is, do you have a family history of schizophrenia?
Right.
If you do have a family history, that's not to say you shouldn't use cannabis, but just use it with caution. Use only lower doses of THC. Just use what relieves your symptoms and don't go overboard.
Yeah, I think with things like mental health disturbance, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, psychosis, I've always felt it's a bit of a chicken or egg thing because a lot of these conditions start to present in late teens. And they may present in ways that the teen isn't really aware or conscious of what it is. They just feel off, or they just feel disconnected, or they just feel depressed or anxious. And they really aren't to the point where they can start looking at this as a cluster of symptoms connected to a disorder. And then self-medication happens. And they start using high amounts of cannabis because they have this feeling of being disconnected, being socially outcast, not feeling like they're kind of with everybody else. And so that leads to high amounts of cannabis use, which then can either bring symptoms on faster or can bring them on more severely, but may not be bringing on something that was never there. And so it's really difficult, I think. I mean, I don't think that adolescents should be using any mind-altering substance in great amounts because of developmental issues in that time of life and decision-making and everything that's going on. But I do think that it's important that if you're, and this is just my social worker hat coming on, if you have an adolescent that is using a large amount of a psychoactive substance, not just punishing them for using a substance, but really looking at what's underneath. What are they experiencing where they are
Why
feeling
or why are
inspired
they using that much?
to use that much? Because, even though experimentation may be quite normative in the teen years, excessive use is not. And so, I think it's important that we not punish teens just for use, but we say, look, if you're feeling the need to use it this regularly, what's happening underneath there and how can we support you? And it just also makes studying this relationship extremely difficult to show any kind of causation other than just correlation between consumption and symptoms. So that's just, I will go up my little mental health tangent there.
Well,
But
that's exactly it. On several, as part of like one reason to get a medical card too is if you're under the adult age, it may be the only way to access cannabis for your particular condition. But one thing I always counsel my patients on, that are younger is like I counsel them on exactly what you just talked about, and that I more or less kind of require them to be seeing a different doctor about this issue because. I'm like, this should not be just managed with cannabis. You're too young to be using cannabis like this alone. That's not to say it's not a good treatment option, but we need to figure some things out.
yeah, absolutely. All right. So let's move off of adolescence and talk a little bit more about adult consumers and adult patients. So we mentioned, family history, personal history of severe mental health issues may be a reason to be more aware of how medical cannabis may impact you. Maybe having another physician that you can consult with when you're using medical cannabis. What about other medications? Because a lot of times people may be using cannabis after trying opiates, for example, but it doesn't mean that that's all that they're using. So are there certain medications that may be contraindicated for use with medical cannabis that people should be aware of?
So kind of some technical background on like interactions between cannabis and certain medications. A lot of it has to do with liver enzymes. We call them like the CYP enzymes, the CYP enzymes. And they're the enzymes that are in our liver that are responsible for metabolizing certain medications, either activating them or deactivating them. And they're activity is strongly related to the effect of the medicine. And you only have so many of those enzymes. So if they're being used, they're not going to be available to process other medications as well. So cannabis is also processed by those same enzymes. And so a lot of the interactions happen by essentially causing that metabolism to be altered. You know, usually for the medication, it would be slowed down because some of it is tied up also in the metabolism of THC, CBD, etc. So generally, what the interaction of medications is going to be is it there's it's going to be like there's more of it in your system. It's not going to be metabolized as fast as it normally would, and so there's more potential for the side effects of that medication to be more prominent. One example is gabapentin. That's a very lots of my patients take that with gabapentin. Gabapentin is a nerve pain medication. It's not an opiate, but it reduces nerve pain. But some of the major side effects are it can make you drowsy. It can kind of make you a little bit mentally foggy. You know, it can change your mood a little bit. And you know, if you are using cannabis alongside gabapentin, you might notice an increase in that sedative effect of gabapentin. And so, you know, those are the things to really be aware of. There's certain like blood thinners. I think warfarin in particular is a big one that if you're taking warfarin, and you use cannabis, you want to adjust your cannabis dose very slowly, because you know, using more cannabis can alter how it's put in your body or how it's metabolized in your body. And, you know, and with warfarin, there's a very thin window of what concentration this medication should be working at to achieve the desired result and not a bad result. And it's really not too hard to throw it out of that balance. And so, you know, when I have patients that use warfarin, I caution them, like, if you're going to change your cannabis dosing, do it very slowly and check in with your doctor and, you know, possibly be retesting to see if that dose needs to be adjusted. You know, so that's another big example. But really, the general thing is just side effects may become more prominent with certain medications.
Well, that's all the reason to seek out a medical cannabis physician that is going to talk to you and do a history and understand what else you're using so that they can make sure that your other medications don't all of a sudden increase in side effects. I have a dog that has Addison's disease. She's on prednisone. I was warned against using CBD with her because it will enhance the effects of the prednisone. And so, you know, it's important to understand how these things work together, especially if you're going to be using both these medications long term.
Yeah, and you know, on that too, it's like this is also why you want to bring this up to your primary care doctor or your specialist because they may have a really good idea of your medications, and then you know they should know if there's this potential interaction and should they be adjusting things. One thing in particular is even surgery. Like people, if you're about to go in for a surgery, let your doctor know because they're probably going to tell you, or they might consult the anesthesiology team. But there is an interaction with THC and anesthetics before going to surgery, and they're going to want to know that. They're not going to punish you. They're not going to stigmatize you. They just want to know because then they'll say, "All right, so based on this procedure, we'd say you probably should stop using cannabis for about a week, 2 weeks, something like that." But that's something that they want to know, and they should know because it'll make your surgery go much safer.
Oh, absolutely. I've had back surgery and two knee surgeries. I was very open with my doctor and my anesthesiologist about cannabis. They did recommend that I stop using cannabis for a period of time prior to surgery. Nobody wants to wake up during surgery. So, you know, being open and honest, you know, I would say even with your dentist, I know that Novocaine ha sensitivity can vary when you use cannabis, especially if you're smoking it. You can require more Novocaine in order to get numb. So these are the, and this is honestly one of the best things about having medical cannabis be legal is that we can have these conversations. And, you know, before it was, you were afraid to tell anyone. And these are things that medical professionals need to know to properly care for you and to make sure that you're not put at risk. So being able to have these conversations becomes really important. All right. The last thing I want to talk about is something that I'm sure you get asked all the time, especially from the people that are new to cannabis, which is, all right, I've got my recommendation. How do I know which product is right for me? How do I know which dispensary to go to? How do I know what's going to work? What do you tell them?
Yep. So usually first thing I tell people is there's really, unfortunately, no one size fits all treatment here. Everyone responds to cannabis completely differently. For example, there's a certain percentage of the population that edibles do nothing for them. Like they will take 1,000 milligrams of THC and feel nothing. They don't metabolize it. There's something about that we're not quite sure of, but we do know that there's a subset of people that have this. There's people that may react to certain strains worse. So typically there's cannabis kind of falls into one of two subspecies. There's like sativa or indica is what you'll hear, and then a hybrid, which is usually some combination of the two. Sativas tend to make people more anxious and not really offer as much of a medical benefit, and indicas tend to be a little bit more sedating, but they tend to offer more of a relaxing pain relief, go to sleep type benefit. But that's not always the case. Some people find sativas to be extremely useful for their various issue. And some people, find that indicas are the way to go. And so there's really no one size fits all. But that said, I tend to steer patients towards edibles, tinctures, things like that, because it lasts longer. That anything inhaled, whether it be by flower itself or a vape pen or concentrate, tends to last about an hour or so. And then it kind of wears off and you're back to doing it again if you still need that relief. The edibles can last anywhere from 4, 5, even 6 hours and maybe even still have a lingering after effect throughout the rest of the day. Tinctures tend to last about 2, 3 hours, but they work a little bit quicker. And so that's the other thing to consider is that with edibles, it can take 45 minutes to an hour sometimes to really start working. Tinctures take maybe about 10, 15 minutes. And then anything inhaled is usually within a couple of minutes. Right. It works pretty quickly. And so if you need that immediate relief, the inhalation is more of the immediate method, but tinctures are pretty close behind. Then you got edibles, which is going to take a while. And so, when trying to figure out what product that you might want to use, again, don't be afraid to ask the dispensary. So the thing is, once you've got your med card, you go into the dispensary, it's a medical dispensary, they are more than happy to answer all of your questions. They're in this business because they love cannabis. They love what they do. And they are more than happy to sit and, geek out about cannabis for an hour if you need. I hear that all the time from patients in that I'm sorry for asking all these questions. And it's like, that's why I'm here. That's why people at the dispensaries are there. We want to help you. We want to answer your questions. So don't be afraid to ask those questions, even if there's a lot of them, especially if you've never really used cannabis. They will happily walk you through, here's this product that really tends to help with this. And they can give you the dosing recommendations as well. But general advice is start low, go slow with edibles. Like start at a low dose. And if you wait an hour and you're not feeling anything, do not take another, because you might be one of those people where it takes 90 minutes to kick in. And all of a sudden now you've got two doses kicking in. You just overdid it and it's not going to be a great time. Start low with a low dose and just see what it does. If it doesn't do anything, give it half a day or a full day and then try another dose later. You want to be careful not to step too far, because it's not a good experience to accidentally overdo it. But on that note, there's never been any case of THC overdose leading to death. That's not a thing. So you're not going to have any sort of permanent issue or anything like that if you overdo it. It's just not pleasant.
Right. Well, I love tinctures. Tinctures, I think, are the most underrated way of consuming cannabis. I understand there's not a lot of ritual around it. And so, a lot of people don't choose that. But I like it because of the quick onset. You can take it anywhere. And you can find very specific cannabinoid ratios in
Yes.
tinctures that are full spectrum. They have multiple cannabinoids, but they have, it's really hard to find a high CBD, low THC flower. It's really hard to find a high CBD, low THC edible, but you can find a tincture that's 5-to-1 CBD THC or 1-to-1-to-1, which is what my dog is on, THC, CBD, CBG. And so you can really play around with that cannabinoid ratio and you have that fast onset. I will say, the nano-emulsified edibles that you see in the dispensaries now that are fast acting, that don't go through the liver in order to be metabolized, you are going to feel those effects in about 10 to 15 minutes, which, I think is also good for trying to titrate your edibles dose. But I'm with you. You really want to find your minimum effective dose. You want to find the smallest amount you could possibly take and still get the effect that you're looking for. And you're right, there is no fatal risk of taking too much THC, but for some, especially for somebody who's newer to cannabis, it can be a scary experience and it may make them not want to use it again, or it may make them associate panic or being overwhelmed with using cannabis, which can be tough to shake off. So, really taking your time. And one of the apps that I really love that's out there is Tetragram, where you can track all of the products that you're using, because sometimes you might find something that works really well for you and then you can't find it again. Or you don't remember what it was called, or you want to go in the dispensary and they don't have it, but you want something that's just like it. So you can record exactly what you're using, not just the brand, but what the makeup is of that product, whether that's the percent of THC or the terpenes that are in it, or the cannabinoid ratio if it's a tincture. And then you can record how it's working for you. How much did you take? What did it do for your symptoms? And it really helps you find that product again, find what works. And then you can even take that to your doctor when you go to renew your recommendation and talk to them about what you've been using and what's been working for you. I've been educating medical cannabis patients for over 2 decades, and I always tell them, you are the best judge of what works for you. You might be able to get recommendations from other people with your same condition or from bud tenders, and they're definitely useful. But when it comes down to it, you are the best one to know what works for you. And so keeping a journal, writing down what you're using and how it's working is the best way to notice what the patterns are that are going to bring you relief and what you want to avoid. So I recommend that people definitely take that practice on.
Yeah, absolutely. 100% agree with that.
Well, I think we're about out of time. Dr. Gerhardt, this has been just an amazing conversation. I think there's so much great information in here for people out there that may be curious about becoming patients. Maybe they already are patients, but just want to know a little bit more about how to refine that experience and how to make it even better for them and how to reduce the risks. Cannabis has a lot of benefits. Nothing is without risk. So it's really having all the information that you need to minimize those risks and maximize those benefits. So again, thank you so much for being a great guest, and I really appreciate your time.
Of course. Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I love talking about this stuff, and we're at that state now kind of with this stuff where it's important to have those discussions, and we're more free to do so now. Don't be afraid to talk about this. There's a lot more people that are going to support this than you might think. So,
Awesome.
this is absolutely something that's been up and coming, and I'm happy to be a part of it.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, and thank you for joining us.
Of course. Thank you very much.
New Frontier Data provides this podcast for entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated in this podcast should be taken as legal or financial advice. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by the company. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by New Frontier Data employees are those of the employees and do not necessarily reflect the view of the company or any of its officials. If you have any questions about this disclaimer, please contact our legal department.